Chapter 13. Madness. Prisoners who were certifiably maimed, incapacitated, or seriously unwell were now eligible for repatriation. The Medical Commission of the Swiss Red Cross assessed which POWs were sufficiently sick, injured, or disturbed to return home and made recommendations to the prison authorities. Sorting out the genuine cases from the malingerers was a tricky task, for prisoners were willing to go to extremes to appear seriously ill, swallowing soap or tinfoil to mimic tuberculosis, or eating cigarettes to colour the skin yellow, suggesting liver failure. In one camp, a man injected his penis with condensed milk using a fountain pen to simulate gonorrhea. MI9 connived with the medical subterfuge, dispatching a game of draughts to Colditz with a piece that unscrewed to reveal a pill which generated symptoms of jaundice. Evidence of serious mental illness was also considered grounds for being sent home. Here was Green's opportunity. I boned up on the symptoms of paranoia and started a campaign which I had cleared with the senior medical officer. He claimed to be dying of indigestion and exhibited extreme neurosis whenever the Germans were watching. He read Vanity Fair a dozen times until he could recite large chunks from memory and did, ad nauseam. It became easier to insert secret messages into his letters since these increasingly made no sense at all. He wandered around the courtyard insisting that all the other prisoners in Colditz were potty and only he was sane. He appeared before the prison doctor, wearing only my boots, socks and glasses, and loudly declared that he was being held against his will among a group of lunatics with barbed wire fever. The doctor made soothing noises, and after examining my chest and making sure I was not homosexual, I was dismissed. 2 weeks later, Green was told that he and Frank Flynn were going to Leipzig to be examined by Professor Wagner, a celebrated psychiatrist at the university. A peculiar quartet boarded the train at Colditz. A dentist pretending to be mad, an RAF officer on the very cusp of real insanity, and two extremely apprehensive armed guards who had been told they would be held responsible if these two madmen tried to kill themselves or each other. No sooner had the train pulled out than Green shouted, "I am the only normal man in Colditz." "Be quiet," said Flynn. "You're sick." "Who's sick, you crazy bastard?" shouted Green, lurching to his feet. Flynn leapt up, and the two prisoners set upon one another, fists flailing. The guards threw themselves on us and pushed us back onto our seats. Green and Flynn were moved as far apart as the small compartment would allow, with the sentries forming a human barrier between them. The rest of the journey we spent glowering at one another. Allied bombs had reduced Leipzig to a wasteland of ruins and rubble. "Look what your communist Jewish Churchill has done to our city," shouted an old man as the British prisoners were marched through the desolation at gunpoint. Trudging past the wreckage of the Deutsche Kreditanstalt, headquarters of one of Germany's oldest banks, Flynn let out a shout of triumph. "Bloody good bombing! The bastards have asked for it." The civilians picking through the debris stared angrily. "Shut up, Flynn," hissed Green. "Do you want to get us lynched?" Green was no longer in doubt. Flynn was completely unhinged. Professor Wagner ushered Green into his consulting room with a courtly bow. The psychiatrist was a tall, slim, distinguished-looking man with an air of detached amusement. "Do you cry? Are you depressed?" he asked, as soon as Green was seated. "I don't cry," Green replied. "But who wouldn't be depressed being locked up with a crowd of loonies who dislike me because I am sane?" The professor took copious notes as Green ran through his repertoire of fake insanities. Finally, the German doctor rose and solemnly announced, I will recommend you go before the commission." Their eyes met, the psychiatrist and the dentist, and then Wagner did something that very nearly sent Green into a fit of giggles. I will swear he winked. On the 6th of May 1944, the Red Cross Medical Commission arrived in Colditz, consisting of four medical officers, two Swiss and two German, accompanied by Rudolf E. Denzler, the Swiss government official responsible for overseeing relations between POWs and the camp authorities. Denzler was by now a familiar visitor in Colditz, a funny, tall, untidy sort of fellow, balding and stooped, who frequently left spots of blood on his collar where he cut himself shaving, and wore a pair of pince-nez on the end of his nose. Belying his scruffy appearance, the Swiss diplomat was a man of painstaking precision when it came to rules and regulations. Under international legal custom, when countries are at war, defending the interests of those countries inside the territory of the enemy usually falls to a third nation, or protecting power. By 1944, neutral Switzerland was acting inside the Reich for 35 nations, including Britain and the US. The protecting power section of the Swiss legation was based in what had been the US Embassy in Berlin. Denzler was responsible for British and American POWs and civilian internees, and he insisted on doing everything by the book. The book in this case being the Geneva Convention of 1929, which Denzler had memorized and held in almost biblical reverence. He saw his role as that of an arbitrator, informing the Germans when they were violating the convention and ensuring the prisoners' rights were known to them and respected. In many cases, differences of opinion could be sorted out on the spot, either due to concessions by the Wehrmacht or suitable explanations of the POW's rights and obligations. Whenever a serious dispute arose, Denzler was summoned to mediate. Thanks to the patience and hardly surpassed tolerance of Captain Eggers, these confrontations often ended in refreshing humour, he wrote. Over the course of the war, Denzler visited 42 different POW and work camps and wrote up 350 separate reports. He spoke fluent officialese in three languages. He was punctilious and ferociously precise. In most people, bureaucratic pedantry is annoying, but Rudolf Denzler's nitpicking was nothing short of heroic. A total of 29 officers were selected to appear before the medical commission. Some were genuinely incapacitated or seriously ill. Others were faking it to work their ticket home. And a few, like Frank Flynn, dwelled somewhere in the psychological no-man's land in between. Douglas Bader, whose tin legs made him the most famously disabled soldier of the war, was on this list, along with Kit Silverwood Cope, whose brutal treatment in Paviak prison had left him with thrombosis. The day before the commission arrived, the German army authorities, without explanation, struck six names off the list. This provoked a ferocious row, and something close to outright mutiny at the next roll call. Rudolf Denzler demanded to know why the names had been removed. Commandant Pravit called Berlin. The Wehrmacht backed down, and the names were reinstated, in what Eggers considered a 100% capitulation. The outcome of Frank Flynn's interview was a foregone conclusion. Everyone in Colditz, British and German alike, believed he had lost his mind. For months, Denzler and the other Swiss inspectors had been urging his removal on medical grounds. His behaviour, merely eccentric at the start, had become ever more erratic and violent. Errol Flynn was no longer acting, if he ever had been. During 4 years of imprisonment, he had spent 6 months in solitary. He knew that this would be his last escape attempt. Flynn had decided that if he was turned down for repatriation, he would make a dive at the wire, during the exercise hour and try to climb over it in full view of the sentries. He knew exactly how that would end. I would have been shot. The commission took 5 minutes to issue a recommendation for his immediate repatriation. Green's appearance before the commission was also perfunctory. The panel asked exactly the same questions as Wagner, and the dentist gave identical answers. "You have passed the examination," the Swiss colonel presiding told him. "You can go home to England." Green was about to utter a celebratory whoop, but caught himself just in time and retained his dour expression. "That's no use. I live in Scotland." "Well, you can go home," the colonel said kindly. But Green did not go home to Dunfermline. Although all 29 officers were recommended for repatriation, including at least 4 who were falsifying or exaggerating their conditions, several remained prisoners. Douglas Bader, the Germans argued, had lost his legs back in 1931 and should not therefore be classified as a casualty of war. Moreover, he was simply too valuable a prisoner to be relinquished. Silverwood Cope had sustained considerable ill treatment after recapture by the Gestapo, according to Denzler, and the Germans were unwilling to let him return to Britain as living proof of Nazi brutality. Just as he never knew the real reason for his imprisonment in Colditz, Julius Green never discovered quite why the Germans refused to let him go. Pravit later told Denzler that the dentist had been detained as a non-Aryan. Green believed his role in unmasking Walter Purdy lay behind the decision. "I had spoiled their plans to get a traitor into the camp." As the months passed and it became clear he was not going to be released, Green stopped acting insane and instead pretended he did not mind staying in Colditz. He put a brave face on it. That was the only sort of face he had. Flynn's day of liberation passed in a dreamlike blur. I remember being taken down to the doors of the castle, and I was left standing outside. And I thought, this is it. I'm going. It was an overwhelming feeling to see further than the walls. He had passed nearly 4 years inside Colditz, and longer in solitary confinement than any other prisoner. Only Mike Sinclair had tried to escape more often. Flynn had been discovered tunnelling through a wall, trying to break into the parcels office, and hanging from a noose in the washrooms. He had smashed a chessboard over the head of a fellow prisoner and picked a fight in a railway carriage with the placid dentist. He preached his own religion and spent much of his time in prison standing on his head. Flynn later claimed it had all been play-acting, but no one believed him. And in his more lucid moments, he knew that was not true. He never fully recovered. On that last day, standing outside Colditz, he broke down. I could feel water trickling down from my eyes. Both eyes. Not crying, just water pouring down my face. That is a memory I have of freedom. That's what freedom can mean. The tears did not seem quite real to him. He did not know if he was really weeping or not. Henceforth and forever, reality would always be just out of reach. He had won liberty at last, but in the process he lost something he never got back. That is what freedom meant to Frank Flynn. News of the D-Day landings first became apparent in the faces of the guards. Padre Platt noticed a certain agitation among the German soldiers and officers. This was followed by the rumour, put out by German propaganda, that the invasion had been repulsed. But that night, the 6th of June 1944, crouched over the radio in the attic, Mickey Boehm took down the words of John Snagg, the BBC radio announcer, as he declared, "D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress." Behind the walls of their own fortress, the prisoners let out a mighty cheer as the news was relayed. "It was wildly exciting," Byrne wrote. Cheko Kalupka made a bet. If the war was not over by Christmas, he would run naked around the inner courtyard 3 times. Parties are likely to be in full swing tonight, noted the padre. As Grizz Davies Scarfield noted in his diary, we are in a kind of daze, mixed up of joy, excitement, and anxiety. The homemade hooch flowed in torrents. Only one British soldier stood back from the revelry, morose and introspective. Every time someone predicted the war would soon be over, Mike Sinclair flinched. He dreaded that this would happen while he was still a prisoner of war, a failure after all the efforts he had made. In the German officers' mess, Eggers heard the revelry and recognised the sound of looming defeat. The Allies would insist on unconditional surrender. Only a military capitulation would be acceptable, he wrote, leaving no alternative but to go on until the bitter end. Allied victory seemed increasingly likely, but there was no certainty the prisoners of Colditz would still be alive to see it. Just 2 days after the landings, news of a far grimmer sort filtered into the camp. Dozens of prisoners had escaped from the Air Force camp Stalag Luft 3 near Sagan in what is now Poland, but almost all had been recaptured and handed over to the Gestapo. These had been shot out of hand, Padre Platt reported. The Great Escape is celebrated in film and literature as an episode of epic valour. It was also an appalling human tragedy. A year earlier, the prisoners at Stalag Luft 3 had embarked on an astonishing feat of engineering. A set of tunnels over 100 metres long and 10 metres deep, constructed out of 4,000 bedboards. On the 25th of March, 76 men crawled down the tunnel and emerged beyond the barbed wire. Of these, 73 were caught. An enraged Führer initially insisted that every single one of the recaptured officers should be shot. But in the end, Hitler settled for a butcher's bill of more than half. The SS selected 50 of the escapers at random and then murdered them, singly or in pairs. Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of the Great Escape was not the ingenuity of the mass breakout, but the utter barbarity with which it was punished. Word of the slaughter spread swiftly to Colditz. Colonel Willie Todd, the senior British officer, sent a message to the commandant demanding to know if the rumours were true. Pravitt replied with studied vagueness that the number shot while escaping was as yet unknown. But Reinhold Eggers, who was subsequently dispatched to Stalag Luft 3 to inspect its security arrangements, knew the truth. The carnage reflected a dramatic power shift within the Third Reich. Himmler had ordered that any recaptured POWs were not to be sent back to their camps, but were to be handed over to the SD, the Nazi Party Security Organisation. The German army was losing the war, and with it the struggle for power inside the regime. Himmler and his SS thugs were gaining the upper hand, ensuring that the end of the Nazi story would be written in a welter of blood and fury. A few weeks later, Eggers was playing cards in the mess and listening to the radio when regular broadcasting was interrupted for an emergency message. There had been an assassination attempt on Hitler's life. A bomb detonated in the Wolf's Lair, his field headquarters. At first, Eggers assumed the report must be a hoax. Elaborate Allied propaganda. But he was still listening intently at 1 a.m. when the Führer himself, hoarse but very much alive, came on the airwaves to demonstrate that the attempted coup had failed. The July plot, led by Klaus von Stauffenberg, had been hatched in the upper ranks of the German army, the military old guard long seen as suspect by Nazi hardliners. The reprisals, led by the Gestapo, were breathtaking in their savagery. 5,000 suspects were executed, hanged like cattle, on Hitler's specific orders. Under the new Sippenhaft, or blood guilt, laws, relatives of the plotters were also arrested and condemned. Himmler, already chief of the SS, the Gestapo and the SD, now took over control of the Reserve Army, that section of the Wehrmacht responsible for backup troops, guard duties and military prisons. The POW camps, hitherto run by soldiers, who largely respected the regulations on treatment of prisoners, were now under the control of Nazi fanatics. And to oversee the prisoner bureaucracy, Himmler appointed one of the worst, Obergruppenführer, or General, Gottlob Berger of the SS High Command, a figure of outstanding unpleasantness even by Nazi standards. An obedient Hitler crony and ardent anti-Semite, from 1940 Berger ran the SS main office in Berlin. He had played a central role in building up the Waffen-SS, the military wing of the SS, created a unit of convicted criminals known as the Black Hunters, which committed a wide range of war crimes, and personally initiated a plan to kidnap 50,000 Polish children as slave labourers. Described by one historian as unscrupulous, blunt, and inelegant in manner and expression, yet also full of genial loquacity and racy humour, Berger was nicknamed Der Allmächtige Gottlob, the Almighty Gottlob, a play on his name, Gott being German for God. This, then, was the man who now held the future of Colditz and its inmates in his hands. The tightening Nazi grip was felt inside Colditz in ways small and large, some merely symbolic and others highly significant. From now on, the stiff-armed Heil Hitler salute became obligatory, not just among the Germans, but between prisoners and guards. The bloodletting after the July plot introduced a fresh layer of paranoia into the German mess. The more committed Nazis looked on some of their comrades with distrust. No one would catch another's eye, wrote Eggers. Down in the town, the Nazi party bosses staged a parade to express thanks for the safety of our leader at the hand of Providence. The castle garrison were instructed to attend, and all did, with an enthusiasm born of pure fear. People did not wish to seem lukewarm in their loyalty, recalled Eggers, who vigorously concealed his own tepid allegiance to the Nazi regime. An SS squad would appear from time to time, unannounced, and carry out a search of the castle. A small army of self-important officials from the SD arrived from Dresden to conduct their own investigations. These people were more trouble than they were worth, sniffed Eggers. The organs of Nazi enforcement were taking a sinister interest in the running of the camp. His professional pride was affronted by the intrusion, but Eggers was far too astute to show it. The life expectancy of an Allied soldier captured inside Germany shrank dramatically. In the early part of the war, captives were routinely delivered into the custody of the Wehrmacht. Now, they were more likely to be handed over to the Gestapo, the SS, or the SD. As the Swiss official Rudolf Denzler noted darkly, it became extremely difficult to protect POWs who were held by the paramilitary organisations. In the past, downed airmen like Douglas Bader had been taken into captivity with formal military correctness, even respect. Henceforth, bomber crews forced to bail out could expect to be left to the fury of the population. Hitler had already ordered the death of every commando captured in German-held territory. As the Stalag Luft III carnage showed, that execution order now extended to escaped prisoners. Back in January, a Canadian officer named Bill Miller escaped from the outer courtyard of Colditz by clinging on to the underside of a truck. Dopey Miller spoke excellent German. A discarded jacket was found in the nearby woods, but Eggers frankly admitted, "We never discovered how he had got away." Miller's disappearance was initially a cause for celebration, then mystery, and finally deep gloom. Months passed without a word. Miller was never heard from again. His precise fate has never been ascertained, but the most likely theory is that he was captured wearing civilian clothes near Lambsdorff, handed over to the Gestapo, taken to Mauthausen concentration camp east of Vienna, and murdered there in July 1944. The SS was now actively hunting down and exterminating its enemies. As things got worse, wrote Eggers, Himmler began taking it out on the most helpless of all, the prisoners and concentration camp inmates. On the 14th of August, without warning, Czenek Kalupka and another Czech Air Force officer were pulled out of the lines during roll call, put on a train to Prague, and locked up in a jail cell. Under German military law, any German citizen taking up arms against Germany was guilty of high treason and liable to execution. Since the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia, in German eyes, Czeko Kalupka was no longer Czech, but a German wearing an RAF uniform and therefore a traitor, liable to court-martial. Colonel Todd launched a furious objection, pointing out that any such prosecution was a violation of international law. From the Swiss legation in Berlin, Rudolf Denzler fired off numerous representations on their behalf. Czeko, meanwhile, was undergoing Gestapo interrogation and already resigned to his fate. I thought I would never come back from Prague. But then, without explanation, after 2 weeks in prison, the two men were loaded back onto the train and returned to Colditz. Irma Wernicke was waiting on the platform. I've met every train from Prague hoping you would come back, she told Czeko. Thank God you have. The prisoners were now safer within the castle walls than outside them, but only for as long as the German army remained in charge. With the SS in the ascendant, the future of Colditz was highly unpredictable. Its prisoners were defined by their antipathy to the Reich. The Prominente were prize hostages, captive status symbols. If defeat seemed inevitable, the SS might be tempted simply to murder them all in a final symbolic act of barbarity. The Great Escape Massacre had demonstrated the Nazi willingness to wreak collective revenge on prisoners. If the enemy, desperate in defeat, should seek a target among the prison camps, Colditz was the obvious bullseye, wrote David Walker. We thought of that, but did not speak of it. Escaping had always had its dangers. A trigger-happy guard, a local lynch mob, a collapsed tunnel, an ill-tied sheet rope. By the summer of 1944, in contrast, the most likely outcome of a failed escape was a bullet in the back of the neck and an unmarked grave. Unsurprisingly, this had an impact on escape activity. Most prisoners now knew the best chance of getting home was to stay put and hope that the Allies turned up before the SS did. This was not cowardice, but sensible actuarial calculation. David Walker, a man of unquestionable bravery, spoke for many when he totted up the new arithmetic of escaping. If the odds might be 99-1 against getting out of Germany, and the odds might be, as the enemy became more desperate, 99-1 on being shot when recaptured, the odds were somewhat loaded. So, perhaps ignobly, we stopped trying. When Pat Reed was escape officer, escaping had been a game, albeit a serious one. Now it was strictly a matter of life and death, with a heavy emphasis on the latter. Yet, for a hardcore, escaping remained a central preoccupation. The increased danger, the threat from the SS, and ever tighter security measures merely compounded the challenge. For men like Mike Sinclair, the humiliation of capture so early in the war could only be expunged by getting away, whatever the odds. Three officers were found hiding in a drain under the castle archway after a guard heard sounds of digging. Another managed to slip away during the park walk, just as the first escaper, Alain Leray, had done in 1941. He hid in a pile of rubbish under a blanket camouflaged with twigs and strips of cardboard, but was captured within 2 miles of the castle. "The escaping spirit was dying hard," wrote Eggers. "In some cases, it would not fade at all." On the 8th of August, a white wooden sign with black lettering was nailed to the door of the Keller House. Camp Order Number 21. POWs escaping will be shot at. One prisoner already knew what that felt like. As Padre Platt noted in his diary, "Several officers have taken pleasure in informing Mike Sinclair, who was shot at a year ago, of the new order." Sinclair's reaction to this gentle jibe is not recorded. It certainly did nothing to dent his determination, but his close friends had noticed a marked change in his demeanour. Sinclair had never been much of a smiler, but now he wore an almost perpetual frown and looked well beyond his years. The war might end before he got out. The Americans had already landed at Normandy, and they would soon arrive in Colditz, not as liberators, but as inmates.